how creative financing. This presents a unique opportunity to construct a creative transaction that meets the seller's goals and still works for you. Creative financing is the way around these binds. It can also help you get into properties with less of your own money used as a down payment and lower your monthly debt service. This means you'll want to master a number of creative financing concepts like owner financing, where the seller carries the mortgage for you, or assumptions, where you take the responsibility for the seller's mortgage when this is allowed by the seller's mortgage lender. Another concept is called a wrap, where the owner offers you a new loan while keeping and paying down their original loan. The new loan wraps the original. Then there are lease options, leasing the property from the seller until you have the equity or cash to buy it, or private seconds, where you obtain a second loan to cover your down payment on a primary mortgage loan. One more creative financing option is a syndication, where you involve other investors and partners in your acquisitions. Millionaire investors use all the tools in their toolbox to get the deal done. The chart displayed in Figure 103 on the bonus CD illustrates how the numbers might work in a scenario where the investor attempts to take ownership of a $100,000 property through creative financing. You'll note the conventional financing positioned in column 1 is included as a point of reference for these creative variations. In all four of the ownership scenarios shown in columns 1 through 4, it's important you understand that a private second loan can come also from the seller. Just know that secondary liens in general carry less favorable terms for the buyer. That's because it's about collateral. First liens are generally secured against the property, and they are first in line if the deal goes sour and the property must be liquidated to pay back the loan. Secondary lenders account for this in the terms they offer. Also, any of these scenarios can be syndicated if you are unable or unwilling to provide cash or collateral to make these deals happen. In each case, you would negotiate the deal and bring in other partners and investors. Your ability to borrow the money will go through three stages: credit, equity, and cash flow. At first, lenders will look to your creditworthiness as reflected in your credit score. This means having little or no credit card debt, paying your bills on time, and having a history of paying back loans in a timely, responsible way will contribute to a strong credit rating. It also matters that you have some savings available for down payments. Although you may be able to purchase your own residence with little or no money down, when it comes to conventional financing for buy and hold investment real estate, you'll usually need to put your own money into it. The lenders will expect it, and it gives you instant equity. At some point, you will need credibility as well as a credit rating. The lender will need to see that you have made wise investments. The first measure of this will be your equity position in the properties you own. Sometimes you can access this money by getting a home equity loan and using it to make your down payment. In fact, you may become your own lender of choice. The interest rate is right, the approvals are easy, and you have all the control. Beyond self-financing, many of our millionaire real estate investors took advantage of private lending or established a line of credit, using the equity in one or more of their investment properties as collateral. In any case, if you have reached a lender's limit on borrowing, that lender will consider you for more only if you have a very strong, provable equity position in your current holdings. Finally, particularly for larger multifamily acquisitions, the amount of the loan will be based strictly on the cash flow of the property. An institutional lender will require a detailed analysis based on recent and verifiable financial reports of the rental income, expenses, vacancies, and net cash flow of the property. Those lenders are looking to minimize their risks, so they'll be very cautious when considering a large loan on an income property. Your track record and reputation will be as important as the specific numbers on the building. At this stage of your investing, you are likely to be the major factor in people's willingness to lend you money. Your credibility is always with you and can be one of your most valuable assets.
Issue number 6. Maximize your NOI.
The third area of terms you will need to master is maximizing your net operating income, or NOI. This is the ability to run your real estate investments at a profit. NOI is what you have left from your gross rental income after you've covered your vacancies and paid your operating expenses. This is detailed in the Buy and Hold Terms worksheet we've already reviewed in Figure 93 on the bonus CD. Actually, from an operating point of view, there are only rental income and expenses. Vacancies simply reduce your rental income. So there are three things you can do to maximize your net operating income. You can increase gross rental income, control expenses, and minimize your vacancies. Let's take them in that order.
Increase gross rental income.
Millionaire real estate investors achieve higher rents than others. Most of the millionaires in our research group followed the 1% rule of thumb for rents, getting 1% of the property's market value as the monthly rent. For example, a $100,000 house would rent for $1,000 per month. When we looked at rents and values in a large number of markets, that rule of thumb seemed too optimistic, particularly for single-family homes. We determined that 0.8% for single-family properties was probably more realistic, and that's what we used for the examples in the Buy a Million section of the book. But that rule of thumb didn't hold up. Our millionaire investors consistently achieved higher than average rents. How did they do that? As a group, they do five specific things to maximize rents. First, they used rent escalators in their contracts so that the rent would increase year by year without question, negotiation, or notice. It would happen automatically, and the renters would know that they had pre-agreed to it, so it didn't feel arbitrary. While this preset rent increase might not keep up with the actual rental trends, it at least meant that there was some increase even when the same renters were in place for a long time. Second, they made the kinds of improvements that were attractive to local renters and made their properties stand out. What they discovered was that, within reason, people will pay more if they believe they are getting more. Cosmetic improvements and certain amenities can make your rentals uniquely better than the competition's and bring more gross income. Remember from our earlier discussion that raising rents even a few tenths of a percent can have a big positive impact on your net cash flow and returns. Third, some of our investors specialized in government-subsidized housing called Section 8 subsidies. They knew which houses in which areas would qualify for the subsidies, and that allowed them to market this advantage and achieve premium rents. Their net positive cash flow became virtually automatic. Fourth, some of those we interviewed were very good at targeting their tenants. They would work with local real estate agents or apartment locators to attract the right renter, those willing to pay a premium for the right place. They would highlight the quality, features, and amenities of their units. In a sense, they would work to lead generate their tenants in the same way they lead generated their investment opportunities. They would get testimonials from current renters and would ask those good renters for additional rental leads. In some cases, they would target people with short-term needs, for instance, those new to the area or those waiting for a custom home to be built, then give them flexibility in the length of the lease in order to maximize the rental income. The fifth method for increasing revenue was to gain other income from the tenants. Coin-operated laundry and fees for pets, storage, parking, and lawn care could all be additional sources of income. It was highly recommended to have the tenants take care of all their own utilities, with direct personal responsibility for payment to the utility providers.
Control expenses.
Controlling operating expenses is a great way to increase your NOI, and it's only a matter of record keeping and attention to details. Many investors we interviewed set up well-organized systems of bookkeeping and cost accounting. Several set up their own property management businesses. Whether you do it yourself or have a management service do it for you, it's important to watch your expense trends and question anything that seems out of line. Rob Harrington from Boston says he compares his cost sheets from month to month, notes the trends, and looks for unusual changes. Over the years, he has discovered water leaks and faulty electrical units that, if neglected for a long enough period of time, could have cost him hundreds and even thousands of dollars. If you have the right record-keeping system in place and set aside a regular time slot each month to do your review. He says this will not take very much time and you'll be paid well for doing it. Expenses saved are profits earned. Another consideration in maximizing your NOI by controlling expenses has to do with repairs and improvements. We've looked at this in the buy and sell scenario, and we've illustrated the concept of maximum return in Figure 88 of the bonus CD. The most astute investors know that repairs and improvements are not just an issue for buy and sell or fix and flip. They're a major part of the NOI equation. When it comes to improvements, there are three moments of truth. The first arrives after you buy, but before you rent. The second moment of truth occurs while you own and operate. The third and final moment comes before you sell. Repairs and improvements involve making cost-benefit calculations. The right improvements may allow you to get higher rents and a better price when you sell. The wrong improvements may accomplish neither. The right improvements may represent a great use of your cash flow. The wrong ones may not. Improvements are a tax-deductible expense, and the right ones can add value to your property and increase your equity. The wrong ones are just deductions. There are four kinds of improvements. The first are necessary and add value, things like a new roof or flooring. The second are unnecessary but add value. Landscaping and cosmetic enhancements are examples of this type of improvement. The third type of improvement, like plumbing repair, rewiring to code, or foundation work, are necessary, but they don't add value. The fourth and last type of improvement is unnecessary and doesn't add value. Expensive fixtures and amenities fall into this category. This last category is a judgment call and is essentially a matter of whether the costs of the improvements will bring about an equivalent increase in market or rental value. Your support and service network specialists will be able to consult with you on this, so seek them out and listen hard to their advice. The wisest landlords know that repairs and improvements are an NOI financial game. They know that it's not always wise to minimize operating costs at the expense of income and equity gains. They understand these operating costs are, in fact, another form of investing.
Minimize vacancies.
Reducing vacancies and the time it takes to re-rent the property are also important ways to improve net operating income. The key is to anticipate vacancies and have a game plan to market the properties to new tenants. Get ahead of your vacancies, not behind them. When a unit goes vacant, be ready to rehab, clean, prep, and market it quickly. Keep in mind, the more units you own, the more cost-effective it becomes to have staff or service providers perform this service for you. While it may seem obvious that keeping your tenants for a long time reduces vacancies and is a good thing, Rob Harrington says that many landlords are so eager to raise rents that they may alienate good tenants. He makes a good point that it may take a very long time, even at a higher rent, to make up for the lost income from a vacancy.
Issue number 7. Know your options for property disposition.
Selling a property right is just as important as buying it right, and this goes beyond getting the highest price. Beyond staging the home for sale and marketing for buyers, what do millionaire real estate investors do that maximizes their returns from selling? The first thing they do is determine why they are selling. If it's to get immediate cash, then they are like any motivated seller. What they now get to decide is which property to sell and why. For example, they may have to choose between a property that is underperforming as an investment or one that can command an unusually good price in the current market. Making this decision simply takes some thoughtful analysis that includes value and rent forecasting. Now, before you decide to actually sell a property, you should always review your options for property disposition, which are lease option out, refinance, tax-deferred 1031 exchange, or sell. There are other ways to get cash out of a property than selling it. It may meet all your needs to simply refinance the property and pull some of your equity out in the form of cash. Millionaire real estate investor Kathy Manchester took advantage of her strong equity position in a high-end vacation rental to use it as a $250,000 equity line of credit. She taps into this amazing cash resource regularly for short-term buy-improve-and-sell investments and then quickly puts the money back into her home. If you are looking for a way to maximize your price, you can use the lease option out strategy by finding a renter who wants to buy but can't qualify for traditional lending. In the lease option contract, you can offer to apply some of the rent toward the purchase, agree on a higher-than-market rental rate, and negotiate the terms of the future sale at a precise point in time. With this approach, you should have a higher NOI and usually a higher sale price. If the renter does not exercise the purchase option when the contract expires, you can do it again with the next renter. In a lease option or any sale, you can opt to be the lender. Many non-qualifying buyers will pay a premium in both price and interest rate because you are their last or only source of financing. If they default, you get to do it again, probably at a higher price. One of millionaire investor Bob Guest's best deals was on a lease option. The woman who leased his home for a period of 2 years took amazing care of the property. She landscaped, painted, and improved. As with many lease option tenants, she considered herself the owner of the property, even though she had not exercised her option. At the end of the contract, she decided not to purchase, and control of the property reverted to Bob. In the end, he had 2 years of strong cash flow from a great tenant and a more valuable property that had been cared for lovingly. Your next option would be the tax-deferred 1031 exchange, where you sell one property and buy another without incurring capital gains taxes. The fundamental requirement from the IRS is that you reinvest all your profits into the next property or properties within a specific timeline. We'll talk later in the money section about the opportunities to do tax-deferred 1031 exchanges. Lastly, there is always the option of just selling the property. Millionaire investors consider this their last option, since they are always seeking to minimize taxes paid on the net proceeds of a sale. They know that the other options present better ways of preserving their capital, and when necessary, providing them cash.
Network. Together, everyone achieves more.
In all businesses, teamwork is one of the fundamental operating principles. For us, it's not just a feel-good, warm, fuzzy concept. It's about synergy and achieving the best results. That happens only when everyone is pulling for one another and, whenever possible, pulling together toward a common goal. Anything worth doing is more likely to succeed at the highest level when we synergize with others. This fact was made real for us by our millionaire real estate investors. They not only pointed out how others had helped them get started, but told us how important it was all along the way to have a group of trusted partners, mentors, supporters, and providers. I made this point earlier when I talked about your work network and lead generation network. What I want to say here is that your networks must grow as your investments and financial wealth grow. In fact, there will be a direct correlation between the two, as your network will reflect your net worth. There are four things you should do in your network as you grow your financial wealth. Number one, make associating with talent your number one priority. Number two, top grade for ever-increasing leverage. Number three, always work from written proposals and contracts. Number four, protect your reputation and operate with confidence.
Issue number 8. Make associating with talent your number one priority.
Your success will be determined in large part by those around you. As a result, you must proactively surround yourself with highly talented people. You are the social engineer of your own people matrix, the architect of your personal mastermind. Whether you are contracting for labor or employing it, talent is always the key. What is talent? Talent is the intelligence, behavior, motivation, attitude, abilities, and experience of a person that makes that person uniquely suited to do what he or she is doing. That person is a natural fit for the task or venture. Talent isn't a measure of someone's worth. It's not a generalized label for a person. It's always related to the role a person will be playing. Talent is role and task specific. You want to find talented people who do what they do well and love doing it. More than that, you want talent that is fiduciary, not just functionary. This means that the people you choose go beyond doing the job they were hired or assigned to do. They look out for your interest and protect it. There's a terrific comparison of functionary and fiduciary traits in Figure 109 on the bonus CD. For instance, I had an insurance agent who was doing an underwriting inspection of an investment that I was in the process of buying, and his company was going to insure for me. He called me back to tell me he had completed his report and gotten the approval for my insurance. Then he told me he was aware that his company had dealt with a number of foundation issues in that neighborhood recently and that I might want to have it checked out. I did, and while there wasn't a problem with my property, I valued the extra effort of my fiduciary insurance agent in warning me about this. Always work with fiduciary talent. They will make a significant difference in your investment success over time. Getting the right people in your work network doesn't happen by accident. It's a matter of intention and process. Finding talent and establishing a relationship with talent must be purposeful, so you must have a process. A simple process I recommend involves three steps: behavior, references, and track record. Determine people's natural behavior by asking behavior-based questions. Actually, if I'm hiring someone, I always use a behavioral assessment. The DISC test, for example, is a proven low-cost assessment that is widely available on the internet. It can be taken online with a report sent to you. An assessment will help you understand what people are good at and how they tend to act. Are they aggressive or not? Do they work well with people? Are they systematic in their approach? Do they follow rules and procedures? The key is to know what you're looking for and then decide if they measure up. You can sharpen your observational skills when you know what you're looking for. I recently needed some handyman work done on a property, since I was in a hurry and my repairman was tied up. I called a guy who had a small handyman for hire ad in our neighborhood paper. I could tell after five sentences that he was not the man for the job. He had all the verbal energy and emotional expressiveness of a telemarketer. He was selling me from the get-go. I know that good detail workers on physical projects don't behave that way. I wanted a handyman, a craftsman, not a salesman pretending to be a craftsman. Remember that talent means the person's behavior fits the work to be done. Learn to read people's behavior. Find the person who's the right fit, and you're less likely to end up having one. Next, always check references and do second and third level reference checks. In other words, I ask each of the provided references who else I might talk with who could give me insight into this person. For example, the reference may know a neighbor who also used the contractor in question. When I am two or three levels away from the direct references, I usually get the whole picture, the person's weaknesses as well as their strengths. Finally, probe for the track record from that person and from independent sources. I have found that a person usually continues to operate in the way he or she has before, with similar results. This is particularly true with important things such as attitude, work ethic, integrity, and quality of work. In short, make it your business to get to know people. Success leaves clues, so look at their track record until you find the clues you're looking for. Determine who possesses talent, and then make having those people close to you a high priority. Your net worth ultimately depends on the talent you bring into your life.
Issue number 9. Top grade for ever-increasing leverage.
Ultimately, you can't do everything yourself, not if you want to get a lot done in your life. So you need leverage, that is, people who do things with and for you. Every business owner knows this, and all the investors we interviewed told us this. You can't do it all alone, and you'll do better if you don't try, particularly when it comes to investing in real estate. get leverage. Find out which people get it done, which ones do what they say they'll do, and which ones are the best. Use them, contract with them, and hire them. Always be upgrading and never settle. Find the best, expect the best, and continue to work only with those who deliver the best. Those people will help make your real estate investments grow and enrich your life. We'll talk more about building your employed staff when we cover the seventh level in the Receive a Million section coming up soon. For now, I want to encourage you to have the courage to top grade those who are close to you in your investing. Whether it's an advisor, a professional associate, or a service provider, don't be afraid to replace that person. You have the right, and if you care about how things turn out in your investing business, you have the obligation. How things turn out will be a function of who you bring in, and more importantly, who you keep in. I don't know why people are afraid to say no or no more, but they are. Some people stay in bad relationships, and others put up with less than quality work or not getting what they paid for. Don't do that. Care about people and treat them fairly. However, when people don't do what they say they'll do, or don't care about doing it well, move on to those who do care. Don't do it in a mean manner. In fact, always try to let these people know that you care for them as a person. Encourage them in their future work. Give them any personal support you can. And then start working with people who you believe will do a better job. To help make sure you always judge a person's work fairly, you can follow this mantra in your professional relationships. Work first, friend second, and social maybe. It's an approach that works. If you're going to the top, if you want your real estate investments to go to the top, you must top grade the people on your team. The best college or professional athletic teams do this, and their fans expect it. Recruit the best players and play the best players. Some good players may be left on the bench when the best ones take the field. That's what those coaches get paid to do. Top grade. And so do you.
Issue number 10. Always work from written proposals and contracts.
It's not an accident that most states require that all real estate transactions be done by written contract, and only by written contract. No word of mouth, no inferred agreement, not even a handshake, is as enforceable when it comes to a real estate transaction. A written contract is binding, but only its written terms are enforceable. Real estate transactions have a long-standing and honored legal tradition regarding the written word. Besides, putting expectations in writing is fundamental to good business transactions. It makes things clear. It provides for consequences, and it can be interpreted and enforced by a third party. Paper has no memory lapses. Many people mistakenly believe that contracts simply create understanding and agreement. In fact, they do much more. They also provide for misunderstanding and disagreement. Contracts outline not only what will happen and who will do what, but also what will happen if they don't. Good contracts provide for clear and straightforward consequences for default or breach. They also provide for a prescribed manner of dispute resolution or mediation and arbitration. In a sense, good written contracts cover contingencies so that if worse comes to worst, all parties know in advance what will happen. For me, contracts are agreements for disagreement. When everyone is in agreement, no one looks at the contract. It's only when there is disagreement that it gets pulled out and gone over with a fine-tooth comb. As a rule, write agreements to resolve any possible disagreements as agreeably as possible. Do everything in writing. Get your bids in writing, get your proposals in writing, and work from written work orders and job descriptions. Even when it is not a purchase or sale of a property, any agreement you make with someone to do something for you, or for you to do something for another person, should be in writing. The costs, fees, specs, plans, options, deadlines, penalties, and the method for dispute resolution should all be there, in writing and signed by all parties. It's a pay me now or pay me later deal. You do the tough negotiating and agreements up front. or pay with misunderstanding and contention later. I encourage you to be tough up front and get it in writing every time.
Issue number 11. Protect your reputation and operate with confidence.
Your reputation is perhaps the most important asset you have. It's amazing how many people misunderstand this or get it reversed. They believe that reputation is important only when you're just beginning and when you clearly need the cooperation of others. Then, when you're successful and financially independent, you can be arrogant and difficult to work with. They seem to believe that power comes from success and money. In my experience, those with the most success and money are usually the most cooperative and responsible. Of course, there are always exceptions. There are a few successful investors who are egocentric and difficult to work with. Perhaps they have created an erroneous stereotype for the financially wealthy. Your reputation for honesty, responsibility, and cooperation is foundational for your success. Since this reputation was earned over time, it is unlikely that it will change suddenly. The habits you built and demonstrated along the way will be sustained for the long haul. Begin with the end in mind. Treat your reputation as the precious asset it is. Develop it wisely. Protect it fiercely. Follow the 5 rules of engagement we talked about earlier. Do deals. Keep your word. Don't talk bad about anyone. Don't shortchange anyone. And refer business to your work network. And become a person others want to be around, to support, and to cooperate with. That reputation will bring you many opportunities and cost you none. Beyond that, your reputation may reduce the problems you have to deal with. First, people will be there for you when you need them. They will help you find solutions. Second, a good reputation may prevent problems from arising. I experienced this once with dramatic results. A problem had arisen as the result of a transaction. The buyer involved in the deal called me. He said that he had been so upset with what had happened in his real estate purchase that he planned to sue me. When he talked with several attorneys about it, each one told him that I always did the right thing. Turns out, these attorneys were all in my network and knew me very well. As a result, the buyer decided to call me rather than sue me. We resolved the problem, and he was very pleased with the way it was handled. When it was all over, what stuck for me was that other people's opinions of me, my reputation, had prevented a lawsuit against me. The same can happen for you. In your role as an investor, your reputation will come from the way you make offers and do deals. Always do this with respect for the other person and an understanding of his or her needs. One of the most important is honest and straightforward communication. Since your acquisitions will have to meet both your criteria and your terms, you'll usually be making below-market offers and negotiating for everything you can. It will be important for the seller not to take any of this personally or have the sense that you're trying to steal the property. Let the seller know and be sure your real estate agent lets them know that you're trying to help them get their property sold. You are an investor, and you can buy the property only if it is a good investment. If the numbers don't work for the seller, well, that's okay. You're only looking to do win-win deals. It has to work for the seller and for you as an investor. You're looking for deals, not steals. You want to be the one who helps the seller solve his or her need to be out from under the property. The only way you can do this as an investor is to have the numbers work. You must get the right terms. You need to operate with confidence, knowing that you are providing solutions to other people's problems while staying true to your path as a real estate investor. When it works for both sides, it's a true win-win. When it doesn't, it's a move on, move on. And that's okay, too.
Money. Give it a work ethic.
Own a Million is about building equity. Along with equity comes the opportunity for the cash flow it can generate. If we have stayed true to our criteria and met our terms, our real estate investments should be achieving equity buildup and cash flow growth. But are they? That's the question you will be asking continually. Those are the numbers you will be tracking consistently. In the end, investing is a numbers game, a financial numbers game. You must hold your money accountable. You must count it and see if it's working for you. Is it, in fact, and by the numbers, building your net worth and your financial wealth?
Issue number 12. Hold your money accountable to work for you.
Throughout your investing career, you want to be sure that your money is healthy or wealthy. I call this the wise money rule. For me to be financially wealthy, my money must at least be healthy. After many years of business and investment experience, I've come to understand that there are four conditions of money: dead, safe, healthy, and wealthy. I began to understand this in my breakfasts with Michael. Whenever I would show him the money I had in the bank, he would tell me that it was just dead money, that I couldn't become financially independent with dead money. He taught me that my money needed to be alive and working for me. How much additional money it was returning to me each year was crucial. It was my return on investment, my ROI. That was something I needed to measure and hold my invested money accountable for. Over the years, as I've become more financially educated, I came to define those four money conditions in the following way. First, dead money earns interest below the inflation rate. Second, safe money earns interest at or just above the inflation rate. Next, healthy money earns interest that is well above the rate of inflation. Fourth and last, wealthy money earns interest that is above that for healthy money. To put this in more specific financial terms, in today's economic market, dead money would be earning 4% or less. Safe money would be earning from 5 to 8%. Healthy money would be earning from 9 to 12%. Finally, wealthy money would be earning above 12%. Money earns wages just as people do, and for money to become wealthy, it must be paid high wages. The interest or return your money earns can tell you what it's getting paid as it works for you. Your money is gainfully employed or it isn't. If it isn't, it's unemployed or dead. If it's gainfully employed, it's now a matter of how much it's being paid for its work. From the beginning of your financial wealth-building career, you want your money to be earning high wages, healthy, or better yet, wealthy. Some people don't understand interest rates or returns on investment. They know that higher is better, but they may not see how much better. There's an easy way to understand this. Let's assume that you invested $100 every month for 30 years. For simplicity's sake, let's say you put it in an interest-bearing account and kept it there along with any interest you earned. The chart in Figure 112 shows what your total compounded value would be over those 30 years at various rates of interest. What a difference a few percentage points can make over time. At $100 a month for 30 years, we've invested $36,000 of our earned income. At the dead money rate of 4%, we've turned it into $69,636, which probably represents no gain against inflation. At the safe money rate of 8%, we've turned it into $150,030, and it feels a little better. With a healthy money rate of 12% earnings, we've grown our $36,000 into nearly $353,000, almost 10 times what we put in. Our money has been getting paid good wages. But look what happens when our money earns wealthy wages. At 16%, it grows to over $887,000. And at 20%, it goes through the roof to over $2 million. Wealthy money, for sure. Keep track of what is happening with your money. Know what condition it's in and how well it's being paid. You need to keep track of your ROI for each property and for your entire portfolio. You will see what annual return you are receiving on your ROI, the money you have invested, and you'll track the annual return you are receiving on your equity. I call this second number your ROE. You want to know both your ROI and your ROE. The difference is that ROI shows what you are earning annually on the money you initially invested, while ROE shows what you are earning annually on all the equity you have. In essence, your equity is your capital, You could take it out and invest it somewhere else through an equity loan or by refinancing the property. You could also do that by selling the property and exchanging it for another larger property. We'll talk more about that in a while. For now, be clear about equity. It's your money, it's your capital, and you want to know how hard it's working for you. Let's put some real-life real estate numbers to this idea of tracking ROI and ROE. We begin with our earlier example of investing in a single-family property that was worth $70,300 in 1983. Remember, we acquired this property with a 20% discount and a 20% down payment of $11,248. In this example, we assumed a 5% annual appreciation in both market value and rent. Let's look first at our investment performance using a 30-year loan at 7.43%. It would be helpful for you to refer to figure 113 on the bonus CD while we cover this area. As we noted before, after 15 years, our $11,248 investment is worth $112,453, the accumulated equity. We've been achieving this equity buildup from the property's appreciation. Now it has a market value of $146,302. And debt paydown amounting to $11,143. In addition, we're achieving an annual positive cash flow. To determine our ROI during the 15th year, we add up the annual appreciation plus the annual principal paid plus the annual cash flow, which gives us a total annual return of $12,420. To calculate the ROI, we divide that total by the initial investment of $11,248 and get 110.4%. This means that during the 15th year of our investment, we received an annual return of over 110% on our money. You can see in the chart that our annual ROI has grown from 37.7% in the first year to over 110% in the 15th year. You can see that in 5 more years, the annual ROI will increase to 152%. This is just part of the picture. It isn't the whole story about how hard your money is working for you. We know your initial investment is working very hard and getting paid very well. And we know that comes from the leverage power of real estate investing. In just this one property, you've gained a very strong equity position. As you can see from figure 113, at the end of the 15th year, your accumulated equity stands at $112,453. That's your money too. It can and should be working for you. If you keep it where it is, you can calculate how hard it's working or what it's getting paid. We call this your return on equity. And all we do to calculate it is divide your total annual return by your equity. That means in the 15th year of this investment, your ROE is 11.9%. It's still healthy money, and that's a good thing. However, it's not working as hard for you as it once was. In fact, your ROE has been dropping since you made the investment. It was 16.7% in the first year and has been going down ever since. In the next few years, it will probably drop to near 11%. What is happening, of course, is that as you increase your equity position in the investment, your rate of return on that equity decreases even though you continue to get appreciation, debt paydown, and cash flow. This phenomenon is what causes millionaire real estate investors to tap into their accrued equity, pull it out, and reinvest it for greater returns. They want their money, both earned and unearned, to work as hard as possible and get paid as much as it can. That's why they continue to leverage that equity back into additional real estate investments, always buying it right with clear criteria and favorable terms. Our survey of our millionaires showed that they had a 40% equity position in their holdings. Most admitted they could have used cash flow to pay down more debt and increased their equity more rapidly over time, but they chose to keep building their financial wealth by putting that money back to work at a higher wage. You may be wise to do the same thing. Not only will it get you to the own a million level, it can build up an unstoppable momentum that can carry you to the own multi-millions level. In our example, let's now reinvest some of the equity and see what happens to the return on equity. Let's say that at the end of year 14, you refinanced your debt and took out some of the equity. You had $104,286 in accumulated equity, which meant you had a 75% equity position. Let's say you wanted to keep a 40% equity position and or $55,728 and pulled out $48,558 through refinancing. You now owe $83,592. When we again calculate your return on equity for the 15th year, we'll use $55,728 as the denominator. With the added debt, your cash flow will be reduced, but you still will achieve a total annual return of $10,004. Your ROE on this property is now back up to 18%. If you also reinvested the $48,558 by acquiring one or two more properties using our standard model for investment, that money too would be working at a higher rate of return, 16% or more. All this equity or capital is now in the wealthy money condition. The return on investment or on equity is similar if you use a 15-year loan as detailed in figure 114 from the bonus CD. The ROI goes up over time and the ROE comes down. In this case, equity builds up faster and cash flow is reduced until the loan is paid off in year 15, and then it goes up dramatically. As we said earlier, 30-year loans are safer in that you are more likely to get positive cash flow. Also, you can always make additional payments, reduce the remaining balance of the loan, and accelerate the payoff. 15-year loans act more like a forced savings program. You have to make the payments and therefore build equity more quickly. We observed that once they had a solid financial foundation or a good equity position, most of our millionaire real estate investors tended to favor shorter-term loans. However, they continued to refinance, take out the equity, and add more income properties to their investment portfolios.
Issue number 13. Minimize your tax exposure.
In addition to making your money accountable by tracking your ROI and ROE, you want to minimize your tax exposure. This is a fundamental operating principle for all millionaire investors. They understand that taxes are an obligation, but not a mandate. The government wants you to pay what you owe, but gives you many ways not to pay, at least not right away. It's really saying, we will charge you less if you do these things. Looking at it another way, it's saying, we will invest in you if you will do what we want you to do. The government wants you to invest in real estate, hold those investments, or move into bigger ones. In a sense, the government is your co-investor. You are wise to take advantage of what it wants you to do, particularly since that is very advantageous to you as a real estate investor. The first thing you want to do is keep a detailed and comprehensive accounting of all your expenses, including the costs you incur in lead generation and property evaluation. Almost everything you do during your acquisitions, things like inspections, finder's fees, real estate commissions, and so on, represents costs you can use to offset your rental income. Most of those costs can be recaptured even years after they were incurred, at the time when you have begun to achieve positive cash flow. You certainly need to keep track of all your operating expenses while you own the properties. In addition, you can make property repairs and improvements, especially those which add value to the investment, and these expenses are also deductible against current or future income. Beyond all this, you can depreciate the property. In fact, the government requires you to. It's well worth the expense to retain a great tax accountant who specializes in real estate investment. This person will be a key member of your work network. If he or she is not in your inner circle will help you find the best person to be your tax advisor. The first step has been to reduce the realized income on which you will pay taxes. The second step is to reduce capital gains taxes, the amount you pay the government when you realize a profit or gain on the sale of a property. While this profit already is taxed at a rate below most income tax rates, you can delay paying it for a very long time. The two primary ways to do this are through IRAs and 1031 exchanges. You can use your individual retirement account or other tax-deferred savings plans to make and hold your real estate investments. As long as you don't take the money out of those accounts, you do not have to pay taxes, even if you achieve large amounts of equity. You can, if you choose, take that money out later when you need the income. In the end, it's the tax-deferred 1031 exchange that gets massive use by millionaire real estate investors. This program in the IRS tax code allows you to sell and buy properties without having to declare capital gains or pay those taxes. It's a very straightforward procedure, but it takes some planning. First, you need to hire a 1031 qualified intermediary before you close on the sale of one of your properties. That person will act as your guide and escrow agent as you move through the sale of one property and the purchase of the next. After the sale of your relinquished property, you have 45 days to identify the replacement property and a total of 180 days to close on that second property. You want to be looking for the replacement property before or during the marketing of the property you are selling. If you find a good opportunity, you can enter into a contract with a right to assign clause if your first property does not sell, or with a 1031 clause in the purchase agreement if it does. Many people have the mistaken notion that you are exchanging your property with someone else. You take theirs and they take yours. In some cases, that can be done, but it is neither the purpose nor the requirement of a 1031 exchange. A 1031 exchange is designed for you to exchange or sell one property in your portfolio and replace it with another one that you wish to buy. It allows you to keep purchasing larger, more expensive properties without having to pay capital gains taxes on the ones you sell. This is a wonderful way to keep your money working for you.
You, your primary asset.
Don't underestimate what's possible, and don't underestimate yourself. Invest in yourself. Stay plugged in. Seek out role models and mentors. Invest in your personal development and education. Learn everything you can as soon as you can, and never stop learning. Never stop asking questions. Stay into curiosity and out of the need to know it all now. Remember that you are your most important asset. That's not a selfish point of view. Shakespeare was referring to this when he said, "To thine own self be true." The degree to which you develop yourself and achieve your financial wealth-building goals will be the degree to which you can leave a legacy. In the end, others will benefit from what you do for yourself.
Issue number 14. Protect your time.
Arguably, the most valuable asset anyone has is his or her time. So it pays to value it, protect it, and invest it wisely. In the game of real estate investing, at the own a million level, this becomes vital. From start to finish, the best use of your time will always be in generating leads, looking at real estate, and in doing deals. At the own a million stage, you will have two new issues you would be wise to include on your short list. First, you'll want to watch your finances with an eye toward maximizing your returns, which was described in the money section. Second, you'll be holding others accountable to keep your time free. Your growing portfolio of rental properties will need someone's attention. It doesn't have to be your responsibility alone. Things break, toilets and furnaces cease to function on Fridays as often as they do on Mondays. Properties have to be shown. Tenants sometimes need to be reminded to pay the rent. These problems and situations are the stuff from the war stories experienced investors tell, the stories that frighten many new investors away. What our investors made all too clear was that while owning real estate investment properties does make you a landlord, it doesn't mean you have to do the work of one. So don't act like one, hire one. I'm talking about property managers. And there are increasingly more options for investors, large and small, to contract with property management firms for single-family residential, multifamily, and commercial rentals. You simply account for it in your expenses. A typical fee is 10% of the gross rents. Then make sure the properties you acquire have enough gross rent to handle this cost and still generate positive cash flow. If your portfolio is large enough to support this, you may be able to let the economies of scale work in your favor by hiring a full-time property manager as an employee to manage all your properties. This is another area where investors have been quite creative. To protect their time, they not only budget for property management independent contractors or employees, but also cut deals with responsible tenants. In return for free or reduced rents, these model tenants often will manage small multifamily properties on the owner's behalf. Many single-family investors sidestep the issue through home warranties and lease agreements. For example, they purchase a warranty for their property that covers common repairs with a $50 deductible. Then they write into the lease that all repairs are the tenant's responsibility, along with the deductible. This can be marketed as a win for both the owner and the occupant. That's because the renter can call for any repairs at any time for a small out-of-pocket cost, while the owner doesn't have to book repairs around the tenant's schedule. There are a multitude of solutions to the problem of the day-to-day management of your holdings. As your wealth grows, make sure you're holding someone besides yourself accountable to tend to these daily tasks. Your time is too valuable, and your life is too short to collect late rents or fix leaky faucets.
Issue number 15. Protect your assets.
I encourage you to do entity and estate planning as early in the game as you can. I waited too long and had to pay a high price when I finally got the right advice. I cost myself money and opportunities because I wasn't thinking big enough soon enough. I thought I didn't need it in the beginning, and it seemed like an unnecessary expense. I was wrong. If you fail, you need it. And if you succeed, you need it. And if you succeed big and don't have it, not only will it be expensive, but you may have made mistakes you can't undo. My advice is this: do it right, and do it right away. Very early in your investment career, you should meet with a qualified lawyer and estate planner with experience in real estate. Your network will be a good source of people to contact and interview. Once you find the right one or two people, ask all your questions, answer theirs, and make decisions. First, you want to make sure that you and your assets are protected from any liabilities that may arise from your ownership or your position as a landlord. This is the right time to be sure you have proper insurance in place. Second, you want to be sure that your estate is handled properly and that you have minimized the tax consequences for your family and heirs. You want to maximize the tax-free amount you can give while you're alive, as well as minimize the tax burdens on your estate. If you get to work on this early, it will inform some of your investment and acquisition decisions.
Issue number 16. Be learning-based.
First you learn, and then you earn. This old adage continues to be true even for those who have acquired an enormous number of investment properties. Investing is a lifelong learning endeavor. Even the most experienced millionaire real estate investors told us how much they were still learning and how much of an advantage their increased awareness was bringing them. They told us to remind you always to be a student of the game. And that's what I'm telling you now. Never stop learning. To put a twist on the old adage, the more you learn, the more you'll earn. The learning curve is a scientific and research-based concept. It has a real shape, which you can see in Figure 115 from the bonus CD, and a real impact on everyone. What it says is that at the beginning of every venture, when you're a novice, you will put in a lot of time on the task, learning or skill building, without much apparent increase in your skill or your ability to be effective. But don't be discouraged by this. After a certain amount of learning, your skills will begin to show some improvement. Just after that, there comes a very important and exciting time, a period of accelerated growth in both awareness and skill. Suddenly, it all comes together. You get the whole picture and see how every piece fits into that picture.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.